This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The 2016 Major League Baseball season is well into its second month, and if it feels like something's missing this year, that's because something is.
The bunt, the go-to strategy for traditional managers and reliable friend to many weak-hitting pitchers, died this season in Major League Baseball. It was 122, or thereabouts.
Michael Salfino made that declaration last week in the Wall Street Journal, and he's got the stats to back it up. Today, there are half as many bunts, that's when a batter intentionally taps the ball just a few feet from home plate, than there were a decade ago.
In 2004, you would see a position player bunt about once every 4.5 games. Now it's about once every 9 games. So on its way to complete irrelevance.
Why irrelevance? Logic, Salfino says. For years, managers thought it strategic to sacrifice bunt, which usually meant having the batter bunt so a runner on first could get to second while the batter got thrown out at first. Not such a sound strategy, say the computers and statisticians.
Trading an out for advancing the base runner is always a bad trade.
The recent attack on the bunt has felt personal to 34-year-old lawyer, law professor, and freelance writer Randy Leonard.
I loved baseball growing up, but I probably also knew that I wasn't very good. One problem, right? Not having talent. And God bless him, my dad, he loved me, but I think he knew it too. So at night, when we would watch games on TV, we'd watch the Dodgers, and he'd say, watch Brett Butler, watch how he plays. And of course, Brett Butler was one of the game's most prolific bunters, and I just took to his style.
Randy Leonard says he wouldn't have had a baseball career if it hadn't been for the bunt. He was fast enough to make it to first before the fielder threw him out, and he bunted through college. Leonard's baseball career ended a decade ago, but the growing call in recent years to kill the bunt inspired him to look a little more closely at the maneuver.
And as I found, the attacks, although different, are not new. The bunts had a rough history.
Leonard's research took him all the way back to the 1870s when the bunt came into play. From the very start, Leonard found the bunt had detractors.
It annoyed people. It was just kind of a squirrely technique that was viewed as cheap and unmanly, even.
Even President William Howard Taft ridiculed the bunt, saying he wanted to see players hit it out for all that is in them. But around the time Taft said that, in 1904, fewer and fewer players were hitting it out, and the bunt was gaining practitioners. That's because the dead ball era was underway.
They were very cost conscious, so they would use one ball for an entire game. So the ball, because of the technology, started out not being wound as tight. And then over the course of the game, of course, it being beat up time and again, would get even softer. So when a pitcher was throwing you a baseball, it wasn't so much pitching a baseball as it was pitching a misshapen piece of fruit.
Not only that, pitchers were allowed to toss spitballs, and the ballparks were pitcher-friendly.
The fields back then were enormous. The Chicago Cubs played in a field whose center field fence was 535 feet from home plate, and players just couldn't hit home runs.
From the turn of the century to 1908, the number of sacrifice bunts nearly doubled. But Babe Ruth hit 29 home runs in 1919, signaling the end of the dead ball era. What happened to the bunt?
It's been dying a slow death ever since. The owners wanted power in the game because they knew fans wanted power in the game. Fences started coming in for that same reason. And then it didn't take a genius to kind of conduct a rough, and it was rough at that time, cost-benefit approach. And they made the realization that let's take the risk swinging away.
But even as the bunt declined throughout the 20th century, some pro ball players managed to make careers of it.
For me, to be quite honest with you, I looked a bunt every time I got up.
That's Brett Butler. Remember him? He's the former Dodger whom Randy Leonard watched on TV with his dad. He asked me to say thank you.
Well, tell him that's all right. For me, it's just one of those trying to make myself available to all these kids.
Butler, who played in the majors from 1981 to 1997, took bunting seriously. Every morning during spring training, he would get to the field early and take 250 practice bunts.
I was just a small guy, little guy, didn't have a whole lot of pop. And for me, the goal was to get on base. I was a leadoff guy. And for me, the best way I could do that was to lay down a bunt.
And he did get on base. In 92, Butler led Major League Baseball with 42 bunt base hits. Nearly a quarter of all Butler's hits that season were bunts. But Butler and the bunt faced detractors.
I mean, mean, I can remember the first time I faced Nolan Ryan, and there's a guy that you talk about, a Hall of Famer, that threw almost 100. And I remember squaring around and taking a pitch, kind of gauging and seeing what was going on. And he yelled at me from the mound, swing the bat, or I'm going to hit you right in the head. Well, again, there's intimidation involved in that. But the reason why Nolan did that is because Nolan didn't like to field the bunt.
Michael Salfino, the Wall Street Journal's toller of the bell for the bunt, pictures a baseball future in which the bunt and the stolen base, among other tactics on the statistician's hit list, are no longer on display.
Well, I think it's going to be a game that's very pleasing to the mathematically inclined, at least. But I think the criticism is going to be that the game is too uniform and station to station and pretty much just waiting around for somebody to hit a home run.
But Salfino says there is hope for the bunt. As the number of statistically minded managers and general managers grows, more strategy changes will come. High on the list, defensive shifts that pull the third baseman away from the foul line. That, Salfino says, would open up room for more bunts.
Numbers killed it. Maybe numbers can save it, too.
And so the bunt, ridiculed by presidents and Hall of Famers, declared dead in 2016, may roll on.
Finally, I wanted, one last time perhaps, to struggle at something I could control, because the last real struggles were going to be ones I could not.
The struggles Gerald Maserati, magazine editor, worried about, the ones he felt he wouldn't be able to control, are the ones that frighten lots of people, maybe almost everybody, the ones that end in death. Gerald Maserati wanted to be serious about the struggle against that decline. He wanted to see how good he could get at something before he couldn't get better at anything. So he took up tennis, seriously.
It wasn't that I just wanted to learn how to knock the ball around well enough to make friends at a tennis club. I wanted to learn the proper way, even though it was going to be difficult because I was in my mid-50s at that point.
It was also going to be difficult because Maserati didn't have much of a head start.
I was never an athlete. I wanted to be when I was a kid and a teenager. I was always the shortest and skinniest kid in my school, and it was a blue collar, mostly Italian American school where the kids started shaving at 9, and they were muscled up and bigger than me and faster than me and stronger than me.
In his mid-50s, Gerald Maserati, editor of the New York Times Magazine between 2003 and 2010, was out from under the shadows of those hulks. He decided he wanted to become the best tennis player he could be, and he worked at it much more diligently than most novice players would have done, practicing, traveling to clinics, competing against players who were better and much better than he was, all in the service of learning. And he found a philosophy to sustain him along the way. It comes from a line in Samuel Beckett's Worstward Ho, and it goes like this: ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better.
And it's a quote that's really about staying at it and trying again and again and trying to get better and trying harder to get better.
But Gerald Maserati, magazine editor, didn't find those lines in a book.
It is a line that's tattooed onto the arm of a Swiss player named Stan Wawrinka. Stan has maybe the most beautiful backhand, one-handed backhand in men's tennis, in tennis in general. It's a shot that I have spent years trying to develop. It's considered the hardest shot. And I kept a copy of Tennis Magazine propped open above the toilet in my bathroom. It's on a spread where you see sequentially how he makes this shot. And I would just stare at this whenever I was in the bathroom.
Philosophy made it onto the court, too. Maserati found a coach named Kirill, a tennis pro whom he calls my Russian philosopher.
He knew how to keep me positive. If we were having a session and I was just dumping backhand after backhand into the net, he'd start hitting to my forehand.
Sometimes the attempt to get as good as he could be at tennis hurt, especially in the elbow, the shoulder, and the knees. Nor was it always comfortable in the head, because sometimes the quest led Maserati, the dedicated tennis player, patron of private clubs, into a past where he found he no longer quite fit.
I walk into an Italian deli in Florida, where I'm actually working with a tennis coach at one of these tennis academies, and that world of my childhood comes back to me, and I'm standing there in tennis whites, and I do feel sort of alienated in some weird way. I feel like, I feel out of place here in the kind of place where I should feel most at home.
The trade-off was that by means of his association with tennis pros and tennis clubs and seniors who were former pros and had the leisure to play tennis all the time at those tennis clubs, Gerald Maserati, magazine editor, became a better tennis player. Not a great tennis player, to be sure. Not even a good enough tennis player to much trouble those seniors who'd been playing tennis seriously since their teens. In tournaments, they beat him easily. But Maserati got good enough to make worthwhile the quest he'd undertaken, and about which he's written a book titled Late to the Ball.
I think I did learn more about myself through this journey that I took to become a better tennis player. I think on a tennis court, I really saw how impatient I was. And as a result, I think I'm somewhat more patient. I also think I felt my age. I didn't feel youthful. I was sore. I was whiny and aching, and I think I felt more intensely what it is to be, you know, in my 60s.
Weird. Who wants to feel that? I'm there, and it's not that great. But it's all worked for Gerald Maserati. Fine. And more importantly, he's made of the tennis experience what he'd hoped to make of it when it began, and he talked about struggle and the meaning of struggle and how little any of us finally have to say about how the struggle turns out.
I was in control of a narrative. Unlike some of the narratives I am not in control of, it's a narrative where I'm improving. I'm getting better if I'm able to put in the time, have the will. It's my story, at least for a little while longer.
Gerald Maserati had ambitions beyond tennis when he undertook his quest, or perhaps he discovered them along the way. And I, for one, am glad he shared them in all their ambiguity and perhaps their desperation. Thanks for listening to the Only a Game podcast. Please leave your comments about Only a Game on iTunes and rate us. Sound your podcast trumpet so that all may know, sports public radio style. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Atlanta Braves are bad. How bad? Oh, well, they've won just about one out of every four games they play so far. And if the Braves keep up this pace, they'll finish as Major League Baseball's worst team since 1962. We're going to talk about the Braves and more on this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know. My guests are ESPN the Magazine's Mina Kimes and Sports on Earth's Will Leach. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Well, howdy there.
Mina, you're up first. Tell us a little bit about the news from Atlanta.
Yeah, so a few days ago, the Braves announced they were firing their manager since 2011, Freddy Gonzalez, which wasn't entirely surprising because, as you mentioned, the team has been absolutely terrible. What was surprising to some people was the revelation that with Gonzalez gone, there are now only two non-white managers in all of baseball and zero Latino managers. And this is especially stunning given that nearly 30% of players are Latino. Baseball does have a C-League rule, like the Rooney rule, which requires teams to interview minority managers when positions open up. But as with the Rooney rule, it's unclear if it's working. And now, with Gonzalez gone, I think it's clear more than ever that the league does have a serious diversity problem.
It was really shocking to understand that. And then I felt terrible for being shocked, then realizing, oh, I'm in fact part of the problem. A great example of someone on this is Jose Oquendo. He's been the third base coach for the St. Louis Cardinals for almost 20 years. And every two or three years, a new job comes up. He gets an interview for it. And he's one of the last two or three people. And then he doesn't get it. And then the Cardinals managing job came up, the people that know him the best as well. And he was one of the last people to didn't get it there as either. It's an issue, particularly in a sport like baseball, which not only 30% of the players, but that is the most growing fan base in the sport as well. It's a clear blind spot. It's something they're going to have to get on pretty quickly.
Every time I think about something like this, I'm reminded of Al Campanis, who got fired for saying blacks didn't have the necessities to be major league managers. I can't believe we're still having this sort of conversation. Good managers come in all shapes, sizes, and colors. And in fact, the ones who can speak Spanish have an enormous advantage over the ones who can't.
I think the problem is it's not clear what the solution is. You know, the C-League rule doesn't seem to be working. And there are all these great candidates out there. You know, Sandy Alomar, Manny Acta, who's back with the Mariners, has been doing a great job. So it's unclear, I think, what baseball has to do to fix it, only that the problem exists.
I want to talk a little bit about some lawsuits that appeared on Tuesday. Men who played football at six universities filed class action lawsuits charging that the universities, the conferences, the NCAA mishandled concussions. Georgia, Auburn, Penn State are among the very well-known football schools mentioned in these suits. And attorneys say that there are going to be 50 more of these suits coming down the line within perhaps as soon as the next couple of weeks. There are 22 athletic departments, at least according to a Chronicle of Higher Education study, that are making money. And the median surplus in those money-making programs is about $8 million. How many multi-million dollar lawsuits like the ones that appeared this week is it going to take to encourage people in those athletic departments, not to mention the people in the lots and lots and lots of athletic departments losing money, to consider life without football? And boy, would it change the culture on some of those campuses. Does anybody regard what I'm suggesting here as radically wrong?
I think the only way college football in America gets brought down is if a meteor crashes into Alabama. I mean, you know, these are big suits and they're serious. And I think this new thing where they're actually targeting schools is really interesting, because when this case first came out a few years ago, there were a lot of school specific incidents and examples of negligence that I think more are going to come to light. However, if there's anything we've learned from what's happened with the NFL is that there is a blueprint for dealing with this. And I just have little faith that this is going to really shake up the system.
Well, I live in Georgia, so Alabama is fine. If the meter hits there, that's actually totally fine. No one within the NFL is ever going to say, hey, maybe we shouldn't actually be playing football. But on college campuses, all it takes is one university president or one very organized group of professors to make a big stink about not just the financial aspect of it, but the moral aspect of it. You know, in a lot of ways, I've always thought for those people that find this a cause they want to pursue, colleges have always been a much more fertile ground.
Of course, if some of the colleges aren't doing it anymore, where's the NFL going to find all their players? They might actually have to start a minor league. My goodness. Will, I'll shut up now. I gather that you have been keeping tabs on the Red Sox most popular old guy.
Yeah, you know, people should start paying more attention to the Red Sox. They're very overlooked and not discussed very often. So I want to take this opportunity to shine some light on an under-discussed person. That is David Ortiz. 1 month after his 40th birthday, which was 1 month after my 40th birthday, David Ortiz posted a video on the Players Tribune saying he was going to retire from baseball at the end of the season. So what has happened? David Ortiz is having this great year, and everyone's saying, stay, stay, you can't leave, you can't leave. For David Ortiz to go out on top is so rare that it should be appreciated rather than us being like, no, no, come back again so we can get mad at you when you inevitably struggle because you're the infinitely old age of 40.
This makes me think of Peyton Manning, right? Because if he had gone out on top when he was at his personal best, it would have been after my Seahawks crushed him in the Super Bowl. He wouldn't have hung on. He wouldn't have been terrible last year, and he wouldn't have won the Super Bowl. So it's hard to say, right, which is better. And I think it's an interesting existential question, and it really comes down, obviously, to the personal preference for the player. But as fans, it can be, I think, a little disheartening to watch that final year.
I don't think we have any right to tell athletes when they should retire. I think it's entirely up to each athlete. But there is an image that I have in my head that would be great fun, and that is David Ortiz decides at some point during this spring or summer that he isn't going to retire, and he has to tell the people in all those ballparks across the country to keep all those rocking chairs made out of baseball bats. Also, I can't help, maybe it's the pessimist in me or the dark side or something, it's May. He hasn't had a great year yet. He's had a great month and a half.
Well, if he does come back, the Houston Astros gave up a Stetson for his going away gift. If he does come back,
has to give it back.
We better not see him in that Stetson.
My guest for Three Stories You Should Know have been Mina Kimes of ESPN the magazine and Will Leach of Sports on Earth. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you Google the words concussion, settlement, and loan, you're going to find ads, lots of them, and they're all variations on a theme. The NFL has agreed to pay former players up to $1 billion. No one knows when the payments will begin, and former players are struggling, sick, bankrupt. They need the money. They need it now. And then comes the hook, or rather the promise. We can solve this problem for you. The ads promise loans on the money you're due. No, not loans, advances. And if the settlement doesn't go through or if your claim is denied, you don't have to pay back that advance. The small print may mention that if you get the money, you'll repay that alleged non-loan and interest of 40% or more. The men being offered those deals are especially vulnerable to the pitchman's lure. For more, here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
I first read about the lenders circling former NFL players in the New York Times. Liz Nicholson saw that article, too. It was all over her Facebook and social media feeds. But she says the news wasn't exactly new.
All the people in the NFL world are very aware of what's going on. In fact, there had been a letter that I think was sent out, I want to say, a couple years ago, warning families about this very thing.
Liz Nicholson and her friends can't remember who sent the letter. Maybe it was the Players Association. Liz received the warning because she's the wife of Jerry Sullivan, who was a lineman for the Cleveland Browns from 1974 to 1981. She's also the finance director for the Senate Democrats in Illinois. She knows her way around a financial spreadsheet, and she would likely never recommend that someone take on a loan from an unregulated lender who charges upwards of 40% interest. But these loans aren't being offered to just anyone. They're being offered to former athletes who are showing signs of brain damage.
So risky, so bad. I have a lot of love for my husband and his brethren in the NFL. I'm not saying anything disparaging against them. It's just that so many of them are suffering. And one of the biggest things, Karen, is that they lack impulse control. They're not in the right frame of mind to be agreeing to these loans. And I know that from experience from my husband, Jerry.
Liz and Jerry met long after his football career was over. He was divorced with three daughters.
When I first met Jerry back in 1997, he was $70,000 in debt to the IRS. He had so many issues going on, he could not manage his money. We've been together a long time and been through a lot together. We had 2 years where I left him due to his illness from football. I like to call it the football disease because obviously you can't diagnose CTE until postmortem.
For now, Jerry Sullivan's official diagnosis is early onset dementia. He was given that label when he was only 52 years old. Before that, doctors thought he was bipolar because he had such dramatic mood swings and a difficult time controlling his rage.
As a joke, people used to call Jerry with a G, Scary Jerry, which now that I think back on it, it hurts my heart because I know that Jerry was ill from football. It wasn't that he was just this maniacal, violent human being. He was brain damaged, and that's why he acted out like he did.
These days, doctors recognize mood swings and rage as possible signs of CTE, a degenerative disorder caused by multiple concussions and subconcussive hits. But back when Liz and Jerry started dating, CTE hadn't yet been identified. So was Jerry already showing signs when you started dating? Like, was this already happening?
I would say that, yes, he was. He was showing signs. And I saw those signs, and I chose to ignore them, you know, because I loved him. And I was literally so embarrassed by some of his behavior that I didn't tell anyone about it for fear of people telling me to leave him. And I knew that as an educated woman, I thought, my God, am I like one of these women that's going to stay with a guy who's has the capacity to be violent and scary?
Jerry Sullivan hadn't always been violent and scary. After he retired from football, he got a job, as most of the players from his era did. Sullivan never made more than about $90,000 a year playing football.
He had a lot of good years. He's a very, very bright, wonderful human being. Unfortunately, there's some, he thinks it's embarrassing, but to me, I tell him not to be embarrassed by this. There's a lot of stuff on the internet that you can find as you could read. His rage and depression and lack of impulse control really followed him up, and he was terminated because of his behavioral problems.
So here's what Liz can't bring herself to say, the thing you can read about on the internet. Jerry was the chief operating officer of a company that leased automatic ice machines. He was well-liked. He did a good job until the disease took over, and he was fired for threatening other employees and punching holes in walls and punching holes in ice machines.
It's painful to talk about, and it still is painful to talk about for a lot of women married to these fellows because we love them and we take care of them, but they have serious problems. And it doesn't help that they are larger-than-life characters, both in physicality and, you know, in stature.
It was about a decade ago that Liz left Jerry. She doesn't want to get into the details, but she says things were bad, really bad. Divorce is common among those suffering from CTE. But here's where Liz and Jerry's story is different from those of all but a handful of former NFL players and their families. Jerry applied for total and permanent disability from the NFL. He cited severe orthopedic injury and cognitive impairment as a result of his 8-year NFL career. The process took years, but on January 1st, 2005, the NFL approved Jerry's claim.
Of course, as the NFL continued to deny that there was a link between football and head injury, they were paying us disability for that very thing.
Liz has never figured out why the NFL granted her husband's claim while denying so many others. Jerry went from having no money and no health insurance to receiving a modest pension and qualifying for Social Security and Medicaid.
Had he not received that, I don't know if I would have come back to our home that we shared together because things were going really really bad. And I'm not saying I returned to him because he got the disability award. I returned to him because his spirits went up and he started getting medically treated because he needed to be treated. He needed to go begin the ungodly road of treating early dementia and depression and rage.
Today, Liz says Jerry's violent episodes have softened a bit as the dementia has started to take over. Still, she loves him.
Even with all the brain damage, Jerry's strong enough where you can still see the shining light of his humor. And I think that's something to be commended because a lot of people would have given up by now for the things that he's gone through in his brain. The things that go on in his head, I can only imagine.
Jerry is eligible for an award from the concussion lawsuit. All players who retired before 2014 are in unless they opted out of the settlement. Some former players are still trying to block the deal in court in the hopes that they can negotiate a better one. But Liz says she's not in that camp.
The whole thing about a class action settlement is nothing's ever going to be perfect. You settle, hence the term. There are people in dire need right now. They need this money. It needs to be settled. And the football players and the brothers of Jerry's who need the money need to get that money.
It wasn't until 2 years ago that Liz started talking with the wives of other players. Before that, she says, she was too embarrassed. But now the women swap stories through a private Facebook group. They no longer need to feel alone and isolated. The group has more than 2,000 members. Liz knows some families are desperate for the settlement. She understands why they're considering the high-interest loans. If the league hadn't granted his disability claim, Liz says that she and Jerry might be that desperate.
I don't know if he'd be alive today. I don't mean to say it like that, but it saved Jerry in a way. But had he not gotten that, like all these other players didn't get, of course an award like this might seem very promising to him, you know, because he'd have no money.
It could take years before the settlement starts paying out, and it could take even longer before a player's claim is approved. All the while, interest will be piling up at the rate of 40% or more. And at the same time, the amount of money that player will receive from the settlement pool will be getting smaller, much smaller. It's a sliding scale. The older you are, the less you get paid. So by the time the NFL pays up, and then the lawyers take their share, and then the lenders take their share, there might be nothing left. Liz is worried that some players won't even bother to pursue their claim or seek treatment because of the amount of money they would owe. Liz Nicholson has considered all the ways in which these loans could go wrong for men who are suffering from the same condition as her husband. But she spent less time considering what she would say if one of her new friends asked for advice on whether to take one.
You know what? I would never judge anybody else in this world of the football disease, as I call it. I would never judge them. But what I would tell these women is hold off as much as you can.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
You can link to Ken Belson's New York Times article, NFL Concussion Payouts Have Lenders Circling, at onlyagame.org. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce might just get the chance to say, well, you know what he's going to say, right? And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Check out Only a Game next week when we'll once again reside at the intersection of sports and poetry, the sport being the Indy 500 and the poetry being extremely awesome, as usual. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a son remembers a father who went to war, pitched in the bigs, and struggled with life back home. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Cleveland Cavaliers went into this weekend with a 2-0 Eastern Conference Series lead over Toronto, but perhaps the biggest news to emerge from that series is the fact that we may now have a better idea of what LeBron James' Nike deal is actually worth. You want to help me with the math?
Yes, it could be worth more than $1 billion.
I love when you say that, yes.
His agent is sort of flirting around the numbers, saying merely that it's a fantastic deal. But the intelligent estimate is it's worth $1 billion, and he's actually playing like $1 billion right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, LeBron James is good at earning money and pretty good at basketball as well.
I liked what Paul Bazemore of the Atlanta Hawks said about him. He said, LeBron James is a house that moves like a gazelle. And I don't care how mixed the metaphor is, it's a brilliant thing to say.
Well, the house slash gazelle has moved into fourth on the all-time NBA postseason scoring list behind only Michael Jordan, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Kobe Bryant. Boy, that was a quick ascent, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. And the other nice thing is that he went out of his way to greet Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the hallway outside the locker room. LeBron's an interesting guy. LeBron has become, and I think quite deliberately, a spokesman for the sport in a way even Michael Jordan was never.
The Golden State Warriors won nearly 90% of their regular season games this year, but they've played 12 postseason games, and they've lost three of them. That means they've only won 75% of the postseason. It's time to jump off the bandwagon.
Break up the team before it's too late. Better to do it now than later when you can't do it.
They'll collapse. Chicago White Sox ace Chris Sale is 9-0. On Thursday, became the first White Sox pitcher to win his first 9 starts in 97 years. Eddie Seacott did that in 1919, and I gotta hope things go better for Chris Sale than they did for Eddie Seacott.
That's the old. I mean, Eddie Seacott is now out of the record books for the Chicago White Sox. Yeah, it's a great thing in Chicago. You've got Jake Arrieta on the Cubs and this guy on the White Sox. It's a great time to be a baseball fan in Chicago, but it is a little bit sad to see one of Eddie Seacott's real accomplishments get knocked out of the record books.
Yes, Eddie Seacott, for those who haven't been paying attention for the last 100 years or so, was one of the Black Sox
who was
banned from baseball. Interestingly enough, Chris Sale says Jake Arrieta's better than I am. So he's not only 9-0, he's humble.
He's very humble, yeah, because he knows what can happen when you go 9-0 for the Chicago White Sox at the beginning of the year.
Floyd Mayweather may be fighting UFC star Conor McGregor, and early reports have claimed that he's offering $50 million to McGregor to fight him. This seems an odd way to promote a fight. Do you think this will happen?
I don't think it's good to have one fighter offering the other fighter money to fight him. There's
no.
All kinds of things that could happen, and Eddie Seacott could have told you what could happen.
For one thing, it could put Don King out of business. Oh, wait, that would be a good thing.
No, that would be a good thing.
Sorry. Whatever happens with this fight, I certainly hope that Floyd Mayweather has enough money left to get his hair cut a couple times a month or week or whatever.
Yeah, he apparently pays $1,000 a haircut, unless his hair, like, falls to the barbershop floor and turns to spun gold. I'm not exactly sure what you can get for $1,000.
Well, our listeners don't have the opportunity
to... Plus, he shaves his head.
I was going to say, our listeners
you can do that with a lawnmower.
He doesn't have any hair.
He does, in fact, have his goatee trimmed, too.
Okay,
so
all right.
That's probably the second $999.
Baltimore's Pimlico Racecourse, home to the Preakness. For now, what's the likelihood that could change?
It's very likely. It looks like they're going to try to build a sports and entertainment complex on the site of Pimlico Racetrack, which means the Preakness will move to Laurel Park, and that, of course, is has traditionalists versus capitalists, which is never a pretty thing in the United States. You know, I've always believed they should run all three Triple Crown races at Belmont.
Muirfield has hosted the British Open 16 times, Charlie. Number 17 may be a while in coming because, as one group of members there has put it, a traditional resistance to change is one of the foundations of our unique position in golf and our reputation and also harumph. What's the particular change they're resisting?
The translation from the original coot. The translation from the original curmudgeon is no chicks allowed, basically.
Right, right.
No women at Muirfield.
Tyler Toney recently shot a basketball, and it went in, and he's being widely celebrated for it. What's the big deal there?
apparently, his great gift is playing way above the rim. In this case, 162 meters above the rim and hitting a shot.
Wow.
He threw a basketball from the top of a 36-story building in Oklahoma City and hit nothing but net. His team, which is known as Dude Perfect, and I want to be the mascot because I think if you dressed up as Dude Perfect, you'd be great. The records they hold include the longest shot with your head, which I don't even want to think about, the longest hook shot blindfolded, and the longest behind the back shot.
Hmm.
But they haven't decided if 162 meters up counts as 2 or 3 points.
And finally, Charlie, some of our listeners might have been wondering what Marco Rubio has been up to since dropping out of the presidential race. And this week we found out, right?
Yeah, we do. It's great. I'm all in favor of this. There's a movement, of course, to replace the Confederate generals that are in Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol on the very specific grounds that they're all traitors. So Marco has suggested that they replace the statue of General Edmund Kirby Smith of Florida, Confederate general, with a statue of Tim Tebow. Which I think is a terrific idea, especially if they can arrange for the statue of Bob La Follette across the hallway to intercept the ball.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce and the political writing that sneaks in there from time to time in Sports Illustrated. And he joins me, of course, each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
My father was Tommy Warren. I always think of the fact that he chose not baseball, but his country.
Oklahoma native Tommy Warren made that choice nearly 75 years ago. It led the fastball pitcher on a life path that included active duty in World War II, professional baseball, and a troubled life during and after his time on the diamond. Warren's son David recently told his father's story to producer Greg Eklund.
I visited David Warren in his Leon, Kansas home. In his living room, there's a trunk containing his father's military and baseball mementos. He opens it, and all the memories come back.
My dad was born in 1917. His mother was a Creek Indian woman, and Indians were not treated any better than a lot of other minorities at the time. My Uncle Bunny came along a year after my father was born. They were the only two siblings. Grandpa pretty much raised them, and he worked on the railroad. He'd take off and be gone 5-6 days. When they had to scrounge their own food, Dad was particularly good at finding good hard rocks off the railroad tracks and hitting something, and my uncle would club it to death, and they would take it home, skin it, and eat it. They were tough boys in a tough time in a tough state.
That toughness would serve Tommy Warren well throughout his life. He would go on to become an outstanding athlete. He was All-State in high school basketball and football.
But his big love was baseball. My dad had the desire to be a major leaguer, and he had the ability. In 1941, he got a contract with the Brooklyn Dodgers for 1942. But later that year, all hell broke loose.
United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
December 7th, Pearl Harbor. Bunny Warren was there. The family did not know if he lived or died for many months. My father voided his contract with the Dodgers and joined the U.S. Navy. On January 21st, 1942, he was informed that he qualified for trade school. It was medical. But also, he qualified for the baseball. And they said baseball can come first and trade school second. So he started practicing baseball. At that time, he started a diary, his war diary, and I hold it in my hands as we speak. Part I want to read to you. Changed my mind at the last minute and decided to go to sea. Baseball manager doesn't like it. There you go. This is a man that could have sat there in a uniform and played baseball to entertain people. He was talented enough and they wanted him to do that. But this Indian boy went to war. My dad talked about how when they were on a ship, you listen, are the Brooklyn playing? Is the Yankees playing? You know, what's the score? And they'd be yelling the score up and down the damn ship. You'd have a guy in there at the radio room would be listening to the score and they'd be calling it all over the ship.
Another fastball pitched over the outside corner. Two strikes, one ball.
And he said, you better know who was playing shortstop for the Brooklyn Dodgers. If you didn't know it was Pee Wee Reese, then you were probably a German and we're going to get shot. He was on the Elizabeth Stanton in the fall of 1942. It was assigned to the Battle of Casablanca. And he volunteered to go ashore with the Marines.
David Warren has gotten much of what he knows about his father's service from talking with other veterans. They remember Tommy Warren tending to a wounded officer during the Battle of Casablanca when a grenade landed in his foxhole. Warren covered the grenade with his helmet and fell on it. Warren's medical records in the National Archives don't mention any injuries suffered during that battle, but a month later he fell off a 15-foot ladder while on active duty and suffered a serious head injury. That was the official reason for his return home.
My father was discharged from the U.S. Navy for being unfit to serve. But he had been playing baseball all summer in the armed services leagues with the great stars of the time. The Brooklyn Dodgers signed him and he went to spring training camp at Bear Mountain, New York in spring of 44. And in spring training, he did not give up a run. He pitched scoreless baseball. What an incredible thing, because he was 35 pounds lighter than he'd been when he joined the Navy. He was just a shell of the man he had been. Let me tell you, he did not have a good arm. That took a lot of shrapnel into it. Later in life, pieces of metal fell out of his arm occasionally, and I would ask him what that sound was, and he would say it's shrapnel. So he had to develop other ways to get people out, and he chose the knuckleball. 1944 was a special year for Tommy Warren. He was in New York City playing baseball for the major leagues. This is his only year he played in the major leagues. My dad won one game, and it was at Ebbets Field. I have that ball at home. Dad started a doubleheader against the Cardinals. The Cardinals were on a 9-game winning streak. He pitched the entire first game and was winning pitcher, and they brought him back in as a relief pitcher. And he had the game won except for a throwing error at the end of the game that allowed a run to come in and cost him a double-headed victory. Dad almost won both games. It was amazing.
Warren played minor league ball for more than a decade. He taught baseball to his son David and to the neighborhood kids.
He loved kids, not particularly me. He was beloved by my friends. He could be himself when he was with children, especially if there was a baseball involved. He tried to be a good father, you know, the best he could be with what he knew. But there were problems. By the late 40s, he had a noticeable gambling problem, and it really hurt his baseball career. The bad times were when he was on losing streaks and he would strike out. The only time he ever really beat me, he beat me so bad that blood ran down my legs and stained my tennis shoes and my socks. My mother broke the door open and laid a sawed-off 12-gauge on the back of his head and said, next time you touch him, I'm firing both barrels and I will kill you. And he never touched me again. After Dad got out of baseball, he pushed it as far as he could. He was 44 years old. He had 6 more years to live. And in those years, he just had to have gambling, and he had to be big-time gambling. It had to be dangerous gambling. And I remember that last year in 1967, I went and spent 3 months with him, and it was so serious that he wouldn't have me in his apartment. He had me in another apartment. He was afraid something violent was going to happen. I didn't see him again until Christmas that year. I was at my grandfather's with my mother. They were divorced by this time. And my uncle was there. And normally my dad would stay there the whole time Bunny was there. And he just came in, had dinner, and left, which was real strange. I knew something was really, really wrong. He'd bet 3 games on New Year's Day. Because he lost all 3 and he didn't have the money, he took his own life. The day my father killed himself was the last day I ever placed a bet with anybody. I've never bought a lottery ticket. I don't gamble at all. That started the day he shot himself. It wasn't until my father's funeral that I realized how much he was really loved by the people of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I've got pictures of him taking kids in their wheelchairs and taking them to the games and setting them on the field where they actually felt like they were part of it in their wheelchairs and leaning against the wall with their crutches because he cared. He cared about baseball and he cared about kids. That funeral, it was unbelievable of all the people that were in wheelchairs. Those were those kids that he took to that field. There was so much love among the people there. He didn't know he was loved like that. He didn't know all those kids that he took to the ballpark remembered him and cared. I'm honored that he succeeded where he succeeded, and I'm a little ashamed of his failures. He could have been so much more. I saw so much of the damage he did to himself that it was hard for me as I got older. But now looking back on it, I think he had a lot more positive than he had negative, and I miss him to this day.
David Warren is the son of Major League pitcher and World War II veteran Tommy Warren. In 1955, Warren received a citation from the Veterans of Foreign Wars honoring him for outstanding bravery at the Naval Battle of Casablanca and declaring his status as the first wounded veteran of World War II to return to organized baseball. Our story was produced by Greg Eklund and Gary Wallach. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder and from Steven Steigman at KCUR in Kansas City. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Charlie Pierce, who this week didn't get the chance to say sports.
Sports!
There. Now it's a complete show. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.